They were high school sweethearts who got married and had two kids. It's the Bruins from a new location. They work all day and that's okay. They're the Bruins. She is a journalist. She is a journalist. He is a wonk, 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 wonk. They talk about the news and whatever they want. In the fight for justice, they're on your side. You can't deny. It's the Bruins.
Hello. Excuse me. Hello, everyone. Matt Brunig here. Welcome back. I know some people have been complaining about my sparse participation on the podcast. Even though they know, you must know, that we're going to get 52 hours in. Some have suggested that the episodes that I'm not on don't count towards the 52 hours. You know, we'd have to make that case in front of a judge to see what they think about that. What was the precise promise involved? You know, if one of the Brunigs is on an episode, does that still count as the Brunigs? You know, I don't know. Or does it count as half? Though I proposed that on the Dumb Zone where I was a guest last week, that, you know, maybe we'll count those as half, right? So if it's an hour, we'll count it as half an hour. Under any measure, we're going to get to 52 hours. Now, I'm doing this one by myself, which is an interesting thing to do because I'm not prepared. I haven't prepared anything. So this could go any number of directions. Yeah, we'll see how it goes. Now, why is it, you may be asking, where has Matt been? What's up with Matt? What's the deal? Where's he been? And the answer really is that I've been super busy with legal stuff. You know, technically I'm a lawyer, mostly a podcaster, but also a lawyer. And unfortunately, I'm not able at the moment to talk about the precise content of all that. But I'll say, you know, things aren't going badly. We'll just put it that way in the negative. They aren't going badly. Other than that, one of the issues is that, you know, my kids go to bed at like 8:30. And I kind of, 8:30 to 9, you know, it's just a little process involved. And I kind of have a decision to make, which is, should I, you know, they sleep for about 2 more hours than I sleep in a day. And I really am up when they are up because I get them off to school and all that in the morning. And so if they sleep for 2 more hours than I sleep, then that means I have 2 hours that I can either be up after they go to bed, or 2 hours I can be up before they wake up, right? And so that's like a decision I have to make, essentially, right? Do I go to bed at 9 and wake up at 5? Or do I go to bed at 11 and wake up at 7? And then I suppose, you know, you could do somewhere in between. And especially when I'm busy, but nowadays really almost all the time, I kind of just figured out that it's best to get those extra hours in the morning. Because those 2 hours at the end of the day, I'm so tired, I can't really be all that productive. And so that's kind of what I've been doing. But Liz doesn't do that. Liz stays up pretty late. She sleeps pretty late. And so we used to do some podcasting later in the night. And that's just become a little bit less doable. I don't really know what to do about that. I've been trying to say, why don't we like schedule a time during the week to do it? And, you know, she's very artistic, very flowing. Oh, I can't really commit to this kind of scheduling. So, you know, this is the situation we found ourselves in. In saying that, it is 11 o'clock right now, and I am up. But, You know, so I guess it does happen. Now, for the moment, my kids are with the grandparents, so that has freed me up a little bit. I'd hope to be really super productive during this period, but I keep getting interrupted in ways that I'm not too fond of. So, you know, things are piling up. I really need to crunch down and get things done, but it's been tough. Anyways, here I am. So what's there to talk about? It seems like, in the discourse, I guess I should do my audio grab bag stuff, right? Let me get that going. I'll actually play the jingle this time. How about that?
Don't you worry, don't be sad. It's the audio grab bag.
All right. I found this one. It was from a sort of community meeting in San Jose, I think. And this is one of those, like, we're trying to get feedback from the community on the blah, blah, blah. And community meetings are very overrated. You know, people who show up are not reflective of the society more broadly. They're mostly pretty angry. But this is a fun one because there's a proposal to convert a hotel in the area to temporary homes for homeless women and children. And, you know, what a lovely sounding proposal, right? and it's kind of spiced up a little bit because they say for homeless women and children. So, you know, they know that people, you know, especially don't like homeless men. So they're like, what if for homeless, which is nice, it's temporary, we're going to get transition them, but only women and children. So, you know, you don't have to, you know, we'll discriminate against the homeless men because we know you're more fearful of them. It turns out not a lot of fans of that idea. This thing is 2 minutes long, so I'm going to try to figure out how to clip it, but let's see how this goes.
Officials, you need to listen to us.
Yeah.
Ooh.
This motel conversion is part of a broader effort to provide safe, stable, and supportive housing for our most vulnerable neighbors.
Sounds good.
Specifically at the Bristol Hotel, we plan to utilize this housing specifically for single mothers and their children.
Okay.
Or single women age 60 and older.
Elderly women.
We started online petition and
Mars Tang.
Now more than 1,000 people already signed both online and offline to support our basically our point. We don't against or oppose to provide a home to these homeless people.
Sure.
We feel bad about them.
Yeah.
And we feel it's this society's responsibility to provide the support to those poor people.
Yeah.
And then what we oppose that is this site.
Just not here. Right.
The idea here is for mothers with children, which is, sounds lovely.
Mm-hmm.
But as a mom with little kids, is this temporary housing? Because then you're changing schools, and or is it really housing? And if it's housing, are they paying rent? Are they in and out at certain hours?
Do they have jobs?
Do they have jobs? Do they have to have a job? Are they contributing to the rent?
Yeah, so this is temporary shelter. That'll be a transition.
What's
temporary
that mean?
Shelter meaning if they don't pay rent, we transition them into permanent housing from this site.
What time frame?
Far enough, Claudia.
Make the sound of a panacea. Everything is just going to be hunky dory.
Yeah.
Let me tell you how many drugged out moms I've met with kids to have custody of them.
Yeah. And they should probably be homeless.
I live without talent, and I have three of them.
It's almost nine.
Is the most effective way for us to reject this proposal?
Oh, man. There's some real sick people out there. Real sick people. I like the insistence on, are they paying rent? What the fuck does it matter to you? Like, that in particular. I get, on some level, I mean, it's a little sick, but they're, oh, what if they use drugs? I don't want people who use drugs near me. I see that a little bit, sort of like, you know, I don't want to be around a certain kind of person or whatever. But to sit there and be like, are they paying rent? Are they paying rent to who? Do you own the fucking hotel? What do you care whether who anyone's paying rent? Just, and then, oh, well, I don't know if this is appropriate because if it's temporary housing, then they might move later and have to change schools. So it would be better if they were homeless on the street. That would be a better option for them. Anyways, there's this account I've been following recently called the Hood Research Department, and they have a lot of amusing clips where they go over sort of they research you know, important historical figures and findings and innovations and things like that, and give their commentary on it. And this is a slightly sped up clip, because, you know, don't want to take too long with it, so the voices are a little off, but a slightly sped up clip where they are looking into what is it that Isaac Newton did that is so amazing. Like, what is these great things he discovered? Everyone says he's a genius, and what is, you know, what did he actually do?
Newton laws. If something is already moving, it will keep moving in a straight line at the same speed unless something stops it. Nigga said this, and his whole generation, bro, glazed the fuck out of him.
He got glazed, bro. Well, even he's getting glazed to this day.
Hear him out. The harder you push something, the more force, the faster it will accelerate.
Obviously, my nigga. Like, come on, bro.
This is y'all's genius?
Oh, good stuff. Check out their other stuff. If you're interested in that kind of comedy. I've seen a lot of discussion of Zohran Mamdani, the mayor for New York. No, well, the candidate for New York. This has been an interesting thing to behold. You know, I don't remember exactly when I became aware that he was running. I received some kind of email or textual message to that effect many, many months ago. I'd never heard of Zohran Mamdani, but told, hey, this is sort of the socialist DSA-approved candidate for mayor. You know, you want to help a little bit with policy? Sure, whatever. I didn't do a whole lot, but I did some, you know. He's got some capable policy staff, certainly. And as I say, I'm very busy. And then, you know, but I'm thinking, whatever, you know, it's nice to have someone in the race, but aren't there like 20 people running for mayor? And like, who's, you know, whatever. It's like, I'm thinking, you never know. I'm thinking Dennis Kucinich, Ralph Nader, like that kind of thing. You know, get 1%, 2%, put up a nice showing, maybe get some issues out there, maybe have a really like explosive moment in a debate where you can kind of captivate people and, you know, keep that ball rolling. You know, maybe we can one day grow the left wing, you know, to a sizable faction, and this will be a part of that process. But I'll be damned if he hasn't just risen the ranks like crazy, and is now, you know, within a few points of Cuomo in head-to-heads and in simulated ranked choice voting polls. And so that's kind of interesting. Like, it seems like it's either going to be him or Cuomo. And Cuomo, of course, despicable kind of figure for lots of reasons, kind of disgraced former governor. And it's kind of weird that because Eric Adams did this as well, where you have these people who run for mayor of New York City who don't live there. Like, they just kind of briefly before they run, you know, rent up some kind of residence that they may or may not even actually live in and like physically reside in, and then run for mayor. It's kind of an interesting thing. I guess I don't fundamentally oppose it if people want to elect as mayor someone who doesn't live in the city. I suppose that's fine, I guess, you know, but it's kind of odd because they have these nominal residency requirements, but there's, you know, as long as you have some money and can like rent a place, you can get around them. But that's neither here nor there. What's been interesting here is the reaction to him. And I think this is fascinating in some ways because, you know, the background here is that we've got all this sort of meta discourse about how we need like fresh blood in the Democratic Party. It's this it's this elderly like nursing home for like 60 and 70 year olds. People are dying all the time in Congress off of like key positions. AOC, she spent the election kind of running interference for Biden and then Kamala on Palestine, Israel, and other things like that, like being a really good soldier for the Democratic Party, which, you know, maybe you think that's good or maybe you find that really irritating. It's whatever. I don't really care, I guess. But that's what she did. I'm going to be a good foot soldier out here. I'm going to take what credibility I have with kind of the younger, leftier wing of the party, and I'm going to do everything I can to try to bring them on board. And so in part, that's why you focus and you say, actually, you know, Biden and Harris, they're doing all they can to rein in Israel and to stop, you know, this massacre in Gaza. They're trying every day. And like, you know, they weren't. It doesn't seem like they were from the reports I've seen. But, you know, that's what the younger, leftier part of the party was kind of scandalized by. And she's kind of the, you know, the person that they relate the most to. So she goes out there, does her best, try to win the presidential election. And then what she wanted was a chair position, not even a chair position because they don't run the House, but like a ranking, like the minority ranking member position of, I think it was the Ethics Committee, something like that. Oversight. I don't even know. I probably should have looked this up, but it was oversight or ethics or something like that. And instead, they put in place this other guy who then subsequently died because he was so old. Anyways, I put that out just to, what an odd set of priorities the party has, you know, because who cares who necessarily is the ranking minority member of the oversight committee? Isn't that a kind of thing? Maybe you could give some scraps to the left of the party, give them that kind of not that meaningful position, especially after she spent the whole election kind of running through the credibility that she had with certain people by kind of BSing everyone on the commitment that Biden and Harris had on protecting Palestine or whatever. You know, she did all that for you. She asked for the tiniest little thing and you can't give it to her. Instead, you give it to the guy who almost immediately dies because he's so old. But with Mom Donnie, you would think, okay, guys, here's a guy. Here's a guy. He's young. He's kind of an impressive politician as a politician. Put aside like the specific words he says, which you may or may not like, the specific position issues. But as like a political talent, there's no denying that he's got it. You know, there's no, in the same way that Obama was a very charismatic guy and, you know, could really kind of go out there and captivate people. It's, you know, it's this je ne sais quoi, you know, I don't know what you'd look at it as. I mean, if you want, I could just try to break it up and talk about, you know, appearance and style and how people carry themselves. It's kind of hard to, you know, reduce it down, but there's a lot of charisma there. Very articulate guy, like very smart, very quick in interviews, kind of like funny, you know, disarming in a way. It seems like on the street when he, you know, there's some videos where he's kind of just like running into normal people, seems to have that kind of like retail politics, like Clinton-esque, you know, charm to him in that sense. So he seems to have a lot of political skills. And in a weird kind of David Shore popularist sense of things, he has run a campaign where he's just like, I'm just going to focus. I'm going to be, you know, what they stereotype Bernie and the like socialist left as being, where all they care about are these economic issues. And they, you know, like that's like the battle left They just focus on a handful of things. They're like cost of living and groceries and transit fees and rent and like just that. Like that's all they're, they just want to talk to you about your economic conditions. Well, you know, in the past, the left has been criticized for that. Bernie in 2016 was criticized mercilessly for it. But it seems like these days in the sort of like center moderate populist world, that's actually seen as like smart politics, right? Let's avoid these talking about these kind of hot button cultural topics and just focus, just relentlessly focused on, I'm going to help you with your cost of living and your income and your whatever. All like just and that's what he's done. And that's been a potent mix. There's no doubt that, you know, and remembering he's going from a complete no name who has been in the state Senate, I think, for like 4 years, 5 years, something like that. He's going from being a complete no name thrown into a race with like 16 other candidates and just rocketed to the top of the non-Cuomo candidates. And, you know, like I said, within a few points of Cuomo, he's done all that while being like an open socialist Muslim. Like, I mean, he's got some things that conventionally we would say, you know, are countervailing winds, you know, like that's those things in and of themselves can, you know, it seems like maybe can cause problems for you. So he's such a good politician, if you, you know, that he's kind of been able to overcome that. And then yet, rather than saying, wow, we've got some real talent here in the Democratic Party for once, right? I don't know, Mary Glue from Oregon or whatever, Washington, I guess. No, it's all the same. You're not these people who seem to appeal only to like a handful of centrist pundits like Matt Iglesias and whoever, who just think, you know, Mary Glue and who's a Jared Polis and Richie Torres, they just like just cream themselves over the like, but these people are not appealing at all. This guy's appealing. He's like a normal, you know, guy. And like, so here's some great talent. Let's welcome him to the party. Bring him in. You know, maybe you don't like everything he stands for at the moment, but you know, there's room. Big old tent. We got the big tent. The big tent. Let's bring him into the big tent. And over time, we can, you know, maybe incorporate him into the big tent, get him to be more, you know, of what we'd like to see. But then we get him into the big tent with all his great talent and youth and all these things that we're lacking. But no, actually, let's just mercilessly attack this guy. And the reaction has been, I would say, deranged. I would say very, very deranged. I mean, one, obviously, a big part of what they're doing is just they just want to be like, he hates Jews. He hates the Jew. It's like, really? You think this guy hates Jews? I mean, why? Guys, look, the young left, I mean, come on, right? But like, that's the move. Right. Let's bait this guy. And, you know, that's what they did to Jeremy Corbyn. I guess they couldn't do it to Bernie for some rather obvious reasons. But, you know, in a way, I guess we sort of dodged a bullet, at least for a while, because Bernie, you know, they couldn't trump up that bullshit where they just claim that he hates Jews because he's, you know, not all on board with everything Israel does. They couldn't really pull that on him. But now they're ready to pull it on whoever, including him. And what's curious about it, of course, is who the fuck cares what the mayor of New York thinks about Israel? What are they doing about that? What does it? I mean, I get you're a little, so people do care, but I mean, if you're not stupid and you're thinking about things reasonably, what does it matter? It doesn't matter at all. And he's not focused on it. It's not like he hits the campaign trail every day and like, instead of saying God bless America at the end, just says free Palestine or whatever. That's not his deal. He's almost kind of comically focused on these economic issues. Like I said, rents and groceries and bus fares. And like, that's what he wants to talk about. But the centrists, you know, want to derail him with that stuff. So that's been one vector of attack that I mean, I don't think it's actually been all that successful. I do think it's intriguing. You know, part of the theory of some of the kind of centrist thought leaders of the moment, like center left thought leaders of the moment, is that they're mad at the groups, as they call them, because the groups, they function to do a number of things. One, to criticize the party and to criticize Democratic politicians and drive up their negatives, right? Well, that's what the non-groups, the centrists, the moderates like Richie Torres and whatever, that's what they're doing to Mamdani, right? Just trying to drive up his negatives, even though he's a Democrat, popular guy, he's charismatic guy, so, you know, a talented politician, should be in the tent. They just want to drive up his negatives. And then the other thing that the centrists complain about with the groups and other kind of activist sorts is that they work overtime to try to get Democrats to say unpopular things or to highlight their unpopular opinions or things like that, right? Which is part of driving up the negatives. And this also is what we're seeing, right? Is that the moderate Democrats go in, ask this guy about Israel, even though it's totally irrelevant to what he's trying to do. And the whole point of it is to get him to say what are actually very sensible things, right? About the, you know, like totally defensible positions as far as I'm concerned. But let's do that because even though it's not relevant to governance, it's not relevant to what he's going to do as mayor, and it's just going to drive up his negatives, but it'll give us a chance. We think that maybe we can peel off some New Yorkers, especially Jewish New Yorkers, and that'll be enough to tip it to Cuomo or something. And, you know, it's just I'm pointing this out only because there's this story that a lot of center left people like to tell about themselves where they're so sensible and they're big tent and they're just trying to help the Democratic Party. And these dumb leftists they're just purely into self-expression. They don't think about the practical impacts on the party and on elections to the kind of things they do. They're so focused on driving up negatives. They're so focused on getting Democrats to take on unpopular opinions, sending them questionnaires that put them in difficult spots. Remember the one that they highlight was the ACLU sent a questionnaire to candidates that included a question like, should like undocumented immigrants who are in detainment centers, you know, like sort of awaiting processing and potential deportation or whatever, should they receive like trans affirming healthcare? And this is one that I see Iglesias likes to point to a lot, where they're like, what is the point of this question, right? Like, it's just to really highlight this kind of area of contradiction where on the one hand, well, look, if you're trans affirming, then you should say, yeah, this is medical care. Don't you think that detainees are eligible for medical care? Okay, well then, well, all right. But on the other hand, people think, well, this is a profligate expense for someone who's going to be deported. And also, obviously, there's plenty of people who don't think that that sort of thing is healthcare. And so it's just meant to take this really kind of a charged issue and just increase the salience. And towards what end? How does that help the Democratic Party? How does that help it win elections? To really key in on these divisive issues that aren't really all that relevant to governance, at least, you know, for most people, right? That's the critique. And that same thing is what they're doing with Mamdani in Israel. Just nonstop everywhere he goes, every podcast, they just want to ask him about this shit. I do kind of, I mean, I think he does great. Like, how can I be like, you should do this? But, you know, there's a part of me that would get some catharsis out of him just being like, why the fuck you ask? Like, what is the fucking, who cares? How is this relevant at all? But, you know, like I said, I think his political instincts are better than mine, so I wouldn't actually advise that, but it would be, I'd like to see it. Okay, so there's that, right? There's the, you know, why are they so charged up about this young? Like, this guy should be in the tent. They should be like, oh, we got some talent, some fresh talent in the tent, it seems like, but they don't view it that way. And then they just keep charging them up with this Israel stuff, which has got nothing to do with mayor in New York, and it's just there to be divisive and drive them negative and all this kind of shit that they normally say they hate, but, you know, only when the left does it. But then we have some substantive critique, right? And this is where I've found things to get a little interesting, right? Because, you know, he has a number of proposals. One of them, I helped. I actually helped on a couple of them, but one of them is baby bags. Anyway, I won't go into that because that's not what anyone's talking about. Everyone is apparently cool with that, so, or he's not getting a lot of talk about it. But let me read you this paragraph from Annie Lowrey at The Atlantic. Now, I like Annie Lowrey. I've met her once, I think maybe twice, and she was very pleasant. So, you know, why I say this? Just not come from a place of animus, but I found the piece wanting. I found it wanting. Mamdani is Cuomo's rumpled, earnest foil. Rumpled. I like that. Usually they describe that of like kind of older people, but he's rumpled. His resume is thin. He worked as a campaign operative for a few years before winning a state assembly seat in 2020. That's the one thing here. And this is all fake bullshit, right? And this came up in the New York Times op-ed about this as well. This attack where they're like, he doesn't have the experience. He does not have my experience. And I have a principled position that people need to have a lot of experience. You cannot, you know, be a mayor without a lot of experience. Cannot run for president without. And the experience thing is always fake. It's always fake, right? It's just whatever campaign you're in, if the candidate you like is the one that has more experience, then you're like, that experience means a lot to me. But if the candidate you like doesn't have a lot of experience, then you're like, experience doesn't really matter that much to me. You know, I mean, Donald Trump became president with no electoral experience. Dwight Eisenhower became president with no electoral experience. I remember this debate actually back in 2008 with Obama, where this was in the primary, but I'm sure the Republicans said this as well, because like I said, it's just the thing you do whenever you think your candidate is more experienced. And they would say, well, Obama, he's so inexperienced. When he started running for president, he'd only been in the Senate for 2 years. How is this guy? He's been in the Senate for 2 years. He's running for president. Well, oh my God, what does this guy think? And then now he's, you know, liberal Jesus. Like people think he's the greatest politician ever. 1 to 8 years, you know, like. But that's a thing people do, and I don't mean to dwell on it because it is something people do every time. Like I said, in the 2008 election, I'm sure it was used. By Republicans to say that Romney is better than Obama. And of course, it was used by certain Democrats to say that Clinton was better than Obama. And then I'm sure in 2016, it was used to say, hey, Hillary is better than Trump because she has experience. And on and on and on it goes, right? It's a fake thing. But precisely because it's fake, I find it to be... Do people not have... I don't want to write stupid shit. I mean, that's really as blunt as I can put it. I do sometimes, right? Like, it's inevitable. You put out so much stuff, you don't always get it, you know, perfectly right. I would say my rate of stupid shit is lower than most. But whatever my rate is, I aspire not to run stupid shit, not to write stupid shit. And also to not get caught in making an argument that I know I'm not going to be able to like sustain over the long run. Like if I'm sitting out and I find that for some motivated reason, I'm like, wow, this person doesn't have very much experience and that bothers me. I would take a step back after I wrote it and go, well, what if in the future the shoe is on the other foot and the like left-wing candidate that I like doesn't have very much experience. And then people like well, didn't you say before you care a lot about experience? And then I was like, I would think about the sort of broader application of the principle I claim to be basing my view on. And I would realize that it's going to put me in a lot of contradictory postures. And I will, one, just not want to be in a contradictory posture, but also, two, the fact that you can reflect and realize that, oh, this is actually going to create a lot of contradictions in other kinds of elections where I probably will sometimes favor the less experienced person. The fact that you can see that also should just then reflectively convince you that actually that's just not a good reason to favor someone or disfavor someone, right? The other thing with this experience stuff is, guys, do you want to have young people in the party running for or not? Where are we at on this? Are we still trying to elect people with dementia to the presidency, to all the executive offices, to all of the ranking members or you know, staff, you know, all the ranking members on all the committees in Congress? Is it just going to be the nursing home? Or do you want some young people? Because this is the thing. Young people, they have less experience, you know? One of our favorites, Sana Marin, she was a prime minister of a freaking of a country in her like early 30s, mid-30s, you know? So surely we can have a mayor. Yeah. She was about the same age, like almost exactly the same age as Zohran is. And he just wants to be mayor of New York. She was prime minister of a whole country. Okay, anyways, that's that experience stuff. He is a leftist in the Bernie Sanders mold with a raft of great sounding policies. Free buses, free childcare, cheap groceries, frozen rents. But a lot of these are impractical at best. Free buses would deprive the MTA of needed revenue. Free childcare would require a mammoth tax hike that Albany would need to approve, which it has shown no interest in doing. And I want to focus on those two. It's not true that relying on tax funding for your buses rather than fare funding for your buses deprives it of revenue. I wrote a piece about this at People's Policy Project titled Bad Arguments Against Free Buses. And I find the bus thing really interesting because it's very clear that there is a meme among people who think of themselves as like transit types and urbanist types. They have fully memed themselves into a completely incorrect understanding of how finances work and how fiscal budgets work and things of that sort, right? Every dollar that you charge in fares is a dollar less that you can charge in tax. These things do actually trade off. The relevant question is, whatever it is that you want to collect in fares, figure out whatever that is, right? Because there's going to be some kind of limit. I assume you're not going to be charging like $50 to ride the bus. So whatever it is that you think you can get out of fares, is that a better way to get that revenue than if you taxed the same amount? So let's say it's $500 million that you think you can get out of fares. Is that better than taxing $500 million? And, you know, you can go a number of ways with it. I'm not saying for every service all the time that it would always be better to use tax funding instead of user fees, right? That's what a fare is. It's a user fee. It's a fee user pays. That's what we would call it. So whether you should use user fees or whether you should use taxes, that's a very interesting question. It's one I've thought a ton about over the years. And it's a practical question. It's not really an ideological question per se. There are ideological components to it because you may have to weigh certain questions like, certain impacts of using one or the other on like distributional fairness requires an ideological view on what distributional fairness amounts to. But other than that, for a lot of the stuff is very practical. It's sort of like, well, okay, we might need to use a fee because we don't have enough like there's scarcity involved, and if we didn't have a fee, there would just be too much demand and it would get totally overloaded, right? And so we use the fee essentially to ration scarcity and keep the demand down, right? So that would be like one argument you could use. And then, you know, and then people say, well, that's true of some things and not others, right? So, you know, we use fees to make sure that people don't just like run their electricity nonstop, you know, for no good reason and waste it. So we use fees to try to prevent people from wasting electricity. The same thing for water and stuff like that, right? So in some of, in those cases, right, fees serve a certain kind of demand management purpose. But in other cases, we don't use fees, right? We don't charge fees for people to walk the sidewalks, for example. In New York, we don't charge fees for people who ride bikes in New York. Those two transit modes are fee-free. We don't charge fees for school, right? Free, we have public school, no fees there. I mean, yeah, like I guess some people say, well, don't you have to pay for like Kleenexes, things like that? Like there's, I guess, little bits where they sneak in some money. And of course, obviously with free school lunch or non-free school lunch, there's a fee there. You know, so sometimes we use fees. Sometimes we don't use fees. Playgrounds, local playgrounds don't use fees. And that's an interesting one because obviously there are playgrounds that do charge fees. Indoor playgrounds, as we call them, charge fees. These trampoline parks charge fees. Amusement parks are basically pretty like real fancy playgrounds and they charge fees. So it's like you can charge fees for playgrounds, but these like fixed playgrounds at the schools and stuff, they just decided that hey, we don't really need to be charging fees. It's not really worth it. And it's not like these parks are going to get completely overloaded if we don't charge the fees, right? So there's a lot of ways you can go with it. But instead of debating that, there is this sort of delusion among these transit people that somehow fares are like free money. And you can always, whatever your tax level it is, you could always increase fares. And that's just not true. Fares and taxes trade off with one another. The more you charge people user fees, the less you can tax them. And the more you tax them, the more, the less you can charge them user fees. These things trade off with one another. In my piece, I use the example of healthcare. It's not the case that because we rely so much on private healthcare payments, that that means we have so much more taxes that we can use for other things. No, because if you're relying on every family to pay out $10,000, $20,000 into the private healthcare system each year, that's $10,000, $20,000 that you can't now tax, right? Because you got to make sure that they have it so they can pay it off into Cigna and Aetna and those healthcare institutions. So, you know, it's just wrong to act like, well, this is just free money on top of whatever tax you raise. I can also get more money by slapping a fare on top. That's just not correct. And I wish that people would actually have the much more interesting debate about are fares the most appropriate thing for buses or not. Now, there was a pilot where they had fare-free buses. And what's funny is, it's part of the like little transit circle jerk about this. They would like share this around, be like, ha, see, it doesn't work. And then I read the study or the slides. It's like a slideshow that MTA put out about their free bus pilot. And it looked great. Like, it looked totally fine. The bus speeds, like, there were, I think it's 14% more riders. Like new riders, like new people who didn't previously ride the bus. Some of those are probably coming out off of cars. That seems cool. There were 30 to 30% more rides. I do think this is funny. One of the funny things people will say, and I've seen this before, I think there was an Estonian study where they, because they had free buses for a while, where they go, what happens with a lot of this stuff is that people, they ride the bus more often than they did before. So, you know, maybe when the buses weren't free, if they were 10 blocks away from somewhere, they would walk. But now that the buses are free, they ride the bus. And they present this as if it's self-evidently evidence that that was not good. Like, see, so the bus pilot didn't really work. And I'm just like completely baffled by it. Like, what? Like, okay, so this guy got to get to his place faster and didn't have to walk as much. I mean, if he likes walking, that's good. I mean, like if you want people to walk, just end all the fucking buses. Like, that's a great way to get walking up. Are we trying to maximize walking? Or are we trying to maximize people getting to where they want in, like, the most efficient manner? Like, I define that very weird, where when they're like, partially, yeah, new people ride the bus. Like I said, 14% of riders after they did the bus ride were new riders, people who weren't previously riding the bus. But really, more than that, it's just people riding the bus more. I'm like, that seems great, right? People ride the bus more. That's wonderful. That presumably means it's more convenient for them, and that previously they were doing something less convenient to save money, right? Like, that's good. That's what transportation's for, right? To make it so that you can get places in a more convenient, faster, more comfortable way. And if we're doing more of that, that's solid, right? Anyways, the results were fine. Like, the bus, you know, they did more trips, more passengers. The speeds didn't really decline, not any more than the non-bus pilots. The dwell time, so like when the bus stops and picks someone up, how long does it take when they get to a stop to stop and then get going again? Those increase, but like, of course they increase. There's the 30% increase in riders. So there's more riders to board, so it's going to take a little bit longer for the bus to get going. But on a per rider basis, a per passenger basis, dwell time's actually decreased. So everything all makes a lot of sense, right? You get more riders because it's cheaper. It doesn't actually go slower. I mean, why would, like, you know, the bus, it's not like it gets so heavy that it can't move. Like, it's constrained ultimately by traffic and whatever. Dwell times go up because there's more passengers aboard, but dwell times per passenger go down because now you're not having to wait for everyone to ding their little fare card. They can all just load, including loading on the front of the bus and the back of the bus simultaneously. Like, it seemed great. Like, this seems fine. I mean, you know, I'm not saying, like, it's the most important revolutionary policy. I'm not saying I really care all that much about it. But the idea that it's something that you should be fucking pissed about, just furiously pissed and so mad about it that you're trying to sink this candidate who, like I said, is young, charismatic, successful politician so that fucking Cuomo can win. That, remember, is the alternative in all this, is wild, wild. And then free childcare. Oh, my God, Jesus Christ. How dare this man propose free childcare? And one of the things I think is so funny about that is that New York City recently, under Bill de Blasio, implemented free pre-K, universal pre-K. And when I was in D.C., they had free pre-K from ages 3 up. Jane, my oldest daughter, was in the D.C. free pre-K. So let's understand, what is pre-K? Pre-K is ages 3 and 4. And then when you hit age 5, you're in kindergarten. And then you do that through age 18 or whatever. So we already have free childcare for ages 5 through 18. That's true everywhere in the country. You know, we call it school, but it's the same kind of idea, right? It's like organized similarly. Some adults watch a certain number of kids, you know, like that's how it works. And then in certain places, including in New York City, for ages 3 and 4, I think New York City maybe only has 4 or 3 is like partial, whatever. But they have already done the free childcare thing for age 4. DC has done it for ages 3 and 4. Like that, okay, so, but then when he's like, we should go down to, all the way down to age 1, like, that's crazy. Sure, we can do ages 5 through 18, and yeah, I guess we can do age 4 too, and I guess some other cities have done age 3, but ages 2 and 1, that's fucking insane. Cuomo. Vote Cuomo. Fuck that. What are you talking about? You know? Of course we could do it. Well, it boggles the mind. The same is true with the buses as well. One of the funny things is that we have a free bus system in the U.S. that's bigger than all the other bus systems combined, right? Which is called the school bus system. Now, I don't know if you want to, I guess you might call each school bus system its own system or something, but if you aggregate all the school bus systems and you add up all the passenger miles of the kids who ride the school buses, it's like every urban bus system combined doesn't match that. And we don't charge fares for school buses. I did learn recently, actually, there's a handful of school districts that do charge, like they might make a parent pay like $100 a year or something to use a school bus, but that's very rare. And 99% of the rides on school buses are fare free. So like, it's obviously doable. Now, if you want to, there's compelling reasons why, you know, with the kids and we want to get them to school, whatever. But it's definitely doable. It's definitely practical. We can do it. And then childcare is the same thing. And I find this so, because it's not just that. And like, this is usually the shit you get from conservatives, right? Where they're like, just that old pie in the sky liberal stuff. Free child. Could you imagine the state hiring people to watch children all day? That's not possible. Meanwhile, fucking 50 million kids a day. And those two things are combined. That's the other funny thing. It's like 50 million kids a day, about half of whom, or maybe a little bit more than that. I don't remember the numbers, but like maybe let's say 30 of the 50 million get on a fare-free bus to go to a fucking public school where the government has hired people to watch the kids. That's already our system for like a large amount of people. But then if you're like, hey, let's, you know how those people don't pay fare for buses? What if we just did that for all the buses? And you said, hey, you know how those, you know, kids go and the government pays adults to watch them and educate themselves? Why don't we do that, you know, before age 5? Like, we don't have to start at age 5. We could start at age 1 or 2 or 3 or whatever. Why don't we do that? Totally sensible, like, extensions of programs that are policies that already exist. And the reaction is just like unhinged, mad at this. It's baffling. And then here's this thing. Free childcare would require a mammoth tax hike that Albany would need to approve, which it has shown no interest in doing. Okay, then what the fuck do you, what does it matter? Like, that's the other weird thing. You get this, his policies are really bad. Also, none of them are going to be implemented. Okay, then what are you so upset about? Right? If you don't like the policies, but also think they're not going to be implemented because some of the stuff he wants to do is going to require bills be passed in the New York State legislature, not just in New York City. And obviously the stuff he wants to do in New York City, he's going to require city council approval. If you want to be like, look, he's not going to be able to get this stuff through. Okay, but then why are you so upset about it? Why did you, like, this is an apocalyptic threat that this man is proposing stuff that also none of it will happen. There's something not adding up here. And therefore, also, by the way, we should tank this young, charismatic, big tent politician who's coming in our party and bringing a lot of people with him. We should tank him in order to elect Cuomo because he has proposed policies that will never be implemented. And I'm afraid of those policies, but also they will never be implemented. It's crazy. And, you know, it's these moments. I mean, this is the thing. Sometimes. Actually, it's funny. Matt Iglesias likes to mention him a lot in this episode. He likes to sometimes be like, you're not a leftist. You're not. And like, what he seems to mean about this is just like, I don't know, like I post sensible things. I write in a certain style that's more like technical and wonky. And like, I try to make sure everything is like clear and clean and like comports with certain like economic concepts and ideas. And, you know, like I try to take socialist ideas and package them in the most reasonable possible ways. And also I try to pursue forms of socialism that seem to be the most well vetted, that, you know, I'm not trying to shock anyone and like posture about being radical. Like, I really am just trying to get equality as far as I can get it in the most like practical way. And so, you know, I'll favor things like the Social Wealth Fund, which has great examples of that working. Whatever. I don't mean to go into it, but these accusations that it's like, you're not a real leftist because your affect and attitude is more similar to technocratic writers who tend to be more centrist. And it's like, well, that's just my affect. That doesn't mean that's not my politics. But it's moments like these that are, I think, are very clarifying, right? The elections are the most clarifying moments because you see these people who are like, we're friends. We're kind of on the same team. And I don't know why you guys attack us so much. You're going to need us to win. We're going to need some moderates in there to get a majority so that we can pass things. And, you know, like, it's all like, you guys are so divisive and your politics is so expressive. And, but we're all on the same team. And then these moments come in elections and they just fucking lose their minds and just like start attacking people just way beyond what's reasonable. That it can only be a kind of intra-party pissing match where they're trying to muscle out other people that they say are on their team, but actually they absolutely do not want to cede even an inch of power to. And, you know, it's in those moments. I'm like, I know who my enemy is. I know who, you know. And 2016 obviously was a great example of that. And in some of those elections, you know, the attacks, they don't just stay on the candidates. They start spreading out to pundits you don't like. And so you'll have people who, like, for years and years were like, oh, I love your work. I think it's great. And then all of a sudden they're like just spewing. They just real hatred, really real hateful towards you. And like, what? I thought you liked my stuff. I thought we were on the same team. And now all of a sudden the same stuff you're calling like crazy and stupid and all that. Like, what's happening? And, you know, like at the end of the day, they are committed to a very serious degree to keeping the left out of power, to the point where they're willing to elect Cuomo and derail this guy for reasons that don't really make sense other than to try to continue to kind of hold on to their power position in the party. They don't want to cede anything. Like the real problem with Mamdani is not what he would do as mayor, but just that he would be like a foothold for the left in the New York Democratic Party. And that, you know, that could be an issue that they, you know, they want to smother that in the cradle. You know, like, that's clearly a big aspect of it. And everything is kind of downstream of that. And that's why a lot of the hysteria just looks so deranged and why a lot of the critiques just look so deranged. You know, all of a sudden free childcare is a bad thing. Jesus Christ, it's been a left, even liberal and especially feminist goal for decades and decades and decades. You know, universal healthcare is like all of a sudden, you know, like to see that happen is very eye opening and, you know, important to keep your, you know, stay woke, as they say about, where, and I don't even, and in a sense, I don't even begrudge them for it. I wish they were more honest about it, but of course the dishonesty is part of what makes it effective or more effective than it might otherwise be. I can understand saying, hey, we want to keep the party pure, you know, and we want to make sure that we don't get displaced by, you know, a kind of insurgent left-wing faction that could grow over time. And yeah, I get all that. But I wish, like I said, people were more honest about it and weren't instead most of the time talking about how we're all Big Ten and how they're so sad. It makes them so sad that the left attacks the center left. And, oh, I wish you wouldn't do that. And then they do. They pull this shit. Well, I didn't actually plan to go on that long about that subject, but looks like I have. What else we got here? I guess that's it. I mean, hell, that's an hour on on Mamdani. Maybe I'll do another episode tomorrow as opposed to just dragging this one on forever and ever. But yeah, that's what I got for the day. Adios, mofo.